And
people began to study. At first, somebody like Luther would discover something wrong with the Catholic Church and break with that, even at the risk of his life. And in that age, one did question the Catholic Church at the risk of his life. In all fairness, I think we should say that, and emphasize the fact that's been more or less implied in other lessons, that is that in the day when Catholics were killing so many, even thousands, in the Reformation age, they put to death as many, many people in the effort to stem that tide and stop that revolt against the Roman Church. But on the other hand, the Protestant people killed also. John Calvin was not a Catholic, but he killed those who questioned his belief. There were a few deaths which he ordered as a political leader and ruler in Switzerland and in harmony with his religious beliefs. A man who would teach heresy deserved to be killed, they thought. That isn't the way the Lord asked that his church handle heretics, but we are to mark them and avoid them and reject them, knowing that they are sinners. We are to be very firm in our opposition to people who teach contrary to truth. The truth is not willing to compromise with error, and the Lord doesn't want his people to compromise with error and condone it, smile upon it, or look the other way and let it go ahead unchallenged. Not at all. But in this country, and in Scotland and Australia and other places here and there, there was that Back to the Bible movement. And we think of men like Scott and Campbell and Stone, John Smith, Raccoon John Smith, and John T. Johnson. Numbers of people fought diligently to see the New Testament pattern restored, but they themselves didn't see all of the pattern. They emphasized truth that needed to be emphasized, but they didn't get around to some other truth just as clearly taught. And we talked about that. For instance, there was not the emphasis on the Lord's Supper and on regular attendance that you and I think there should have been. Maybe those people were taught to read the Bible at home and talk about it, and they may have outdone us in that, in many cases. Many individuals heard the truth and believed it. They confessed their faith in Christ and were baptized and went home and read their Bibles and talked to their friends, their relatives, and their neighbors. Since we're talking about things this side of the cross, we do not read as many verses as we would if we were talking about the church as pictured in the New Testament. A step-grandfather of mine was still able to hear and get about and think during his 80s. And when he was about 80, he moved in the house with my mother and dad. And I was still home there for a time. He used to go with me in meetings and stay till he ate too much and had to go home sick. But he liked to talk about the Bible and he liked to hear sermons. And he read that book. He talked about it privately. He didn't come into the church until he was about 40, but that was before my day. So he was a member of the church all the time I can remember, and before I was born. But he wasn't all that convinced that he needed to go every Sunday. Now, this is what I'm talking about at the moment, and I'd like for it to register. I think he was one among 10,000. I mean by that there were others like him. Thousands of them. He didn't attend regularly. It wasn't all that important that he be at the services. He would have argued with you that there should be the Lord's Supper every Sunday, but not necessarily that he should go. But he talked the Bible. He talked it and talked it and talked it. When he came to our house, we only lived about two blocks from the courthouse square, and there were some benches out in the yard under some trees. And in summer, he'd go up and sit on one of those benches, and before noon, he'd have an argument going with some other old person sitting there on that. And there'd be some that'd gather around. And at noon, he'd come home and search for some other scriptures and hurry back downtown to that courthouse square. And he talked Bible and argued Bible, and some of his relatives and people who loved him thought he overdid it. And he just talked Bible all the time. Could you overdo it? Could you talk Bible too much? Maybe we could sometimes need to talk about the weather and something else, but he talked about the Bible. And all of his children and grandchildren were members of the church, and all of his nieces and nephews, practically. Anybody related to him, anyone that visited his home, almost everyone became a member of the church. His step-grandchildren became members of the church. I owe him a lot, a great debt. I believe I owe a great debt to Barton Stone and to the people who've been dead 100 years and more. The men who boldly made attack on error, even if they didn't get all of it, they got some of it, and people could gradually observe more and impress one another with that which they've learned. Any of you feel like you could pretty well sort through history and announce confidently and correctly the destiny? At the judgment day, what are you going to do with Alexander Campbell? He never got out of institutionalism. He became the first president of the Missionary Society. He was a great and powerful leader. He visited in the homes of four presidents of the United States. He walked, as far as worldly relationships are concerned, he walked among the elite. Campbell was a scholar with a mind, especially in the first half of his life, that was amazing for the knowledge it could hold. But the Missionary Society fell into the hands of modernists, and today, since especially 1968, the Missionary Society is the headquarters for the Disciples of Christ. And they recognize themselves as a denomination, among denominations. They're not trying to restore New Testament Christianity. They have much more in common with our Methodist neighbors than they would with us. The Christian church here in Athens is identified with the Disciples group, which means the more liberal wing of the Christian church. In 1968, it split when the convention became the head of that denomination, the Disciples. There was a group of conservative Christian church people that split off. The church divided in Decatur, it divided in Hartsel, just as our brethren divided. Now, those of the conservative Christian church would have the kitchen and the instrument, but they don't send to the society. They don't favor the United Christian Missionary Society at all. And they do not get along peacefully with their brethren in Hartsel. It's on the same street. And the east side of town is the Disciples group, and on the west side, the conservative Christian. When I moved to Hartsel in 1968, I had some very pleasant contacts with the preacher of the Central Christian, they called it, on the west end of town, the more conservative group. And he and I admitted that we could talk with one another more pleasantly, and it is easier for us to discuss our differences than it was for me to discuss our differences with the Sparkman Street Church of Christ. people. And for him to discuss the differences between him and those on the east side of town, the old Christian church that's now, they write the Christian church in a semicircle, and in a line across there, they put in parentheses, disciples, which identifies them as the liberal wing. And there was friction and bitterness between the two groups because they divided. The man said, we may have much more in common than we do with our former brethren. But those in the conservative Christian church say we claim to be only Christians. Christians only. But we do not claim to be the only Christian. So the conservative Christian church today would have a preacher, a member of the Ministerial Association, working in harmony with and in conjunction with those who teach we're saved by faith only. The preacher at Central Christian, the conservative group in Hartsville, gave me a little tract that I could put in my pocket. And I went home and I read it. And it talked about elders in every church, told where we could find the qualification, mentioned the Lord's Supper each first day of the week, mentioned so many things, just like able writers among us would write, point by point. The title of the little tract was The New Testament Church, and they were showing that's what we are. We have elders as they did. We have the Lord's Supper as they did. And we teach baptism for the remission of sins as they did. And I read the tract with interest. It sure began to appeal to me. I said, we do have a lot in common. But after a while, I came to that sentence. We claim to be Christians only, but not the only Christians. Which meant that what we are teaching is right and everything else is too. Well, if what they were teaching was right, then that's the thing that's right, and anything in conflict with it would be wrong. Truth conflicts with everything that's opposite to truth. And this idea of saying, now here's just what the truth says. This is what the Bible teaches. This is what we teach. That makes us only Christians. But we want to say that we think these people who teach everything else and all the things that contradict, they're right too. We're all right. You could take out about two sentences in that tract. Just leave out a paragraph or two. There were two little spots, as I remember, in the tract, that if we took that out, we could give it out freely as being an excellent tract. But those two little things made a difference. Now, we today face a different world to the world in which Walter Scott went out to preach. He went across in what's now northeastern Ohio and baptized 1,000 a year, more or less, on an average, there for several years. The back to the Bible idea sounded good. The idea of just laying down the creeds and all of us meet together and all of us just study the Bible and search the Scriptures until we find just what it says and stand for that. When he was baptizing those thousands of people, many of them studied on their own and pretty soon began preaching. They were not supported to preach. They farmed and made a living, and when they'd get the crop laid by, they'd preach and baptize more. The History of the Western Reserve is a little book about average size or a little less, and it told the name of one after another in that Ohio area, called then the Western Reserve, who learned the truth, obeyed the gospel, and then preached. And in 4 or 5 pages, the whole story would be told, and in about every case, it told how old the man was when he died and what the disease was that killed him. It amazed me when I read the book. So many of them died with what the author called consumption. Some of you older people know that the author was talking about TB. TB killed a very large percentage of those preachers that grew out of the teaching of Walter Scott in the Western Reserve. They died in their 40s. That was a typical age, 42, 44, died with consumption, died with TB. They didn't even use the rest cure. They just worked as hard as they could until they couldn't work, and then they died. And that was the story. But anyway, what are we going to do at the judgment if we are asked to be the judge? When they didn't insist on regular attendance, they didn't insist on partaking of the Lord's Supper each Sunday. They did insist on Bible study and reading. There were some excellent Bible students, we understand, privately, and they taught. We're trying today to talk about the church and the situation as we see it round about us. In the late 30s and early 40s, it wasn't unusual to visit someplace for a meal and sit there and talk. And the man or the woman say, I have a cousin that's a member of one name, one denomination or another around in the community, and been very strong in her beliefs or his beliefs. But told somebody recently, one thing about the Church of Christ: if you attend one of their meetings, they will preach Bible. They will stick with the Bible. Now, when that sentiment began to spread, and that was the thinking of people who were not our brethren, they began to say, well, we go to their meetings as well as to our own and to the other meetings round about, and we find that when we go to their meetings, they do give book, chapter, and verse for what they teach. Now, that's not what our neighbors are saying about the church in Limestone County now. And our neighbors do not come. If there's someone here today in this service that's not a member of the Church of Christ, I want to say that all of us are glad you came. And I don't want to do anything ugly or say anything ugly. I'd like for you to come back. I'd like for you to come back again and again. I'd like for you to feel free to question anything I say or anything anybody else says. Have that independence of mind to search the Scriptures. I congratulate any who do not agree with us and yet have come to listen. It isn't done very much. Our neighbors don't respect us very much. Really? They think of us as a group of fanatics that think we're the only ones right. And we don't think that the truth of God is any more accurate than our parents and grandparents did back 50 years ago or 40 years ago. They thought the Bible was right. I believe no one should preach if he doesn't think what he's teaching is right. If he thinks it's right, he ought to speak up and contend for it. Yes, I believe I'm teaching the truth. Is that ugly? Do I have to be ugly to believe that what I teach is the truth? Do I have to be ugly to believe that anything that conflicts with truth is wrong, is error? But we are put out as cranks and fanatics and pushed aside. I think there are a lot of parents in this county that wouldn't object to their daughter marrying a boy of any religious group in the county except the Church of Christ. I think there are those that have that feeling that strong against us. Everything's right. All the churches are right. One's as good as another except the Church of Christ. We have a mountain against us. But one of the big mountains is within our own minds. We sit in our comfortable chair and think, there's no need of talking to those people over there across the road because they're just not interested. And maybe they're not. Maybe our ancestors were not. Back in yonder, and somebody got to them with the word. The Tennessee River goes right on across and across West Tennessee, and right where the Tennessee River hits the Kentucky-Tennessee line, right at that point, after the War of 1812, my mother's ancestors came and settled there, right? There's a little offset. Kentucky-Tennessee line is straight, but there's a little offset. And right in that corner, right where the river hits Kentucky. I've been in meetings at New Liberty, which is right there, right in that corner. One meeting one year, another meeting the next year, back 30 years ago, 35 years ago. And in the second meeting, an older man said, "I don't want to hurt your feelings. I don't reckon it will, because you're not responsible." But he said there was a preaching done here, and a little church was started, and they built a little house. The Church of Christ. But he said one time the building burned mysteriously. There was supposedly nobody there, and it just caught fire and burned down. And the work cause was weak. The few that were there never rebuilt. That just marked the end gradually of the church in that community. They just lost interest, and there wasn't no more preaching, and that's the end of it. And the thing he thought might be offensive, at least he said he hoped it wouldn't be offensive, he said, if the story that went around in the community was correct, it was your ancestors that set fire to that building. Now, I won't have to give an account if my ancestors set fire to that building. They'll have to give an account. That was a terrible thing for the community when there was a little weak church. And right at that time, the burning of the building was enough discouragement till they just never met again. At least they never continued meeting. And that marked the end of it. And it had to be started over years later. But somebody in there got to my mother's people with the truth. The fact that this certain family across the road is not interested doesn't mean they couldn't become interested. And I'm fully convinced that if we had a bit more confidence, we would reach more people. And when I say we, I'm including myself. I think one of the most difficult things we have to contend with is the idea that we can't. I can't. I can't. We can't. No need of trying. We can't. No hope. Our Lord sent His disciples out to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. And when Paul went out to Corinth, he reached fornicators and thieves and drunkards and converted some of them. Not all of them, but some of them. And when our Lord was here, He found it was easier to reach publicans and harlots than it was the doctors of the law, the ones that were so proud of themselves. Thirteen years ago, in efforts at Arab, there was a family of people, particularly two brothers and their families, that didn't appreciate the liberalism that was coming to the church in that county. They agreed generally with what I believed to be right, and we could sit and talk, and I was invited into their homes to eat meals. But the little North Parkway church, where I can preach, started without their help. When I started going back over there, I went and looked those men up, and they're still cordial, still friendly, and still admit that they don't approve things that go on down at the big fancy building, the Arab, that belongs to the Arab Church of Christ. But they don't come. And I said, why did the North Parkway Church not grow more? I know it had problems on the inside, but what about the outside situation? Why do you think people like you and others didn't go with that work? Well, he said, one thing, you got too many, and he gave a family name. Many of that family had been alcoholics. And got too many of those people in there. Well, we've gotten some more since I've been there. But I'll tell you, I could name the people that are going that were from those, that alcoholic background, and belong to the very family that he named. They're there every service. The one I'm thinking of in particular, I'll just take one as an illustration. She's there every time, and she talks to others and to her neighbors and her relatives. And her spirit is so encouraging to me. I wish the church here and there and everywhere could just have more like her. But she came out of that undesirable liquor drinking background. I baptized recently her husband's sister. And her attitude is good. In her youth, she was right in the midst of that alcohol problem. And I felt like saying, I think I may go some of these days back to these high quality people with their good morals and so many good points, and who are so satisfied with themselves that they are not like these people over there. They're better. They're not alcoholics. And I think it might be in order for me to tell them, you know, I can reach these people like you named easier than I can reach you people who know the errors, and yet you go along and condone and just look the other way and put your money in there to finance and to back the kitchen, the entertainment, the social gospel, the institutional setup. Money you give has gone to institutions that have been big problems to the Church of our Lord and helped bring about a major division in the decade of the 50s. It's easier to reach these who know they're sinners and know they how badly they have transgressed the law of God than it is some who are so satisfied with themselves. You and I couldn't handle this matter of judgment, and it's hard to know what to do. To whom should we go? I believe we ought to go to this one and that one and the one who has been a slave of alcohol and the one that has high record from a moral point of view. We just ought to go to any of them and show them the truth as best we can. The efforts that count are not occasional big, splashy accomplishments. The things that count in the name of the Lord and to the glory of God are little words and little deeds day by day, our daily conduct, our attitudes as expressed by the little things. It may be that if you have a very prejudiced neighbor and there's a long drawn out period of sickness in the family, and you help with food and with the laundry work, and you're over there and you have kind words and you do one thing or another, personally and individually, you may break down that prejudice. And it happened not by some major event, but by the little old deeds. The Church of the Lord needs more women like Dorcas, who died, as recorded in Acts 9, and they prepared her for burial, laid the body out. Peter got there, and she was raised from the dead and delivered back to her friends. But around the body gathered widows, showing coats and garments which she had made while she was with them, and they wept. It didn't say the mayor was there and the president of the bank there and the wealthy landowner. It didn't say that. It was widows that were there weeping. But she had, in a personal way, done something in the community. I have no record on how many I baptized, and my mind doesn't keep records. I'm encouraged once in a while in this county when somebody said, "You baptized me," and they tell me maybe it was 1939 or 1945 or whenever. And I'm so glad if they're still attending and working at it now. It's such a pleasure to me to see one and learn that But now, what if I had a record and I could say I baptized this number? I had very little to do with their conversion in many cases. If I bragged about I baptized so many, certain number, so many hundred people in a lifetime, that's out of place. Because maybe I baptized somebody's son who was well taught at home. Or I baptized somebody who had been attending services a long time and in Bible classes and hearing sermons, and then I came along at the time he was ready to be baptized. Now, should I do a lot of boasting about having baptized that one? I wouldn't know how much credit. I think what we need to do is just lose ourselves in the crowd and just try to do something and a little something else and the little things. Instead of thinking, I can't do some things, therefore I can do nothing. No, you can do something. And it's oftentimes the little things that count. Back in the 30s and 40s, early 40s, I was in several meetings that lasted 4 weeks. When we'd go off 25 or 40 miles from any established church of Christ and just put our tent up, we had a radio program and had the tent then with services every night, just go on and on, and never went a month but that I baptized more the last 2 weeks than I did the first. And in those days, we could get neighbors to come, and we usually expected to baptize some if we tried, if we worked at it. But in one of those meetings, about in the middle of the meeting, I baptized a woman who didn't have a palate or cleft. They had a cleft palate in the mouth and could hardly speak so you could hear. When she was a little baby, they didn't have the surgery to, in her case at least, to repair that mouth so she could speak. She didn't get to go to school much. And she was working then on a project financed by the federal government. It was for women, it was comparable to the WPA, except it was women and their work. They worked with sewing machines and things like that for the relief of needy people. And her salary thus was very, very, very small. She lived in a little unpainted building, never was painted, a little building that set out on stilts back out in the field, and she had no car. I provided a way for her and others to the meeting. And one night it rained, and a car couldn't go to the house and left her at the road. She took off her shoes and walked through the water to the house. No education and could hardly speak, but after that, several that I baptized were people, her relatives and special friends, that she brought to the services. I don't know who it is that can't mean a lot in the cause of the Lord, if that one will try. She was enthusiastic about what she'd learned, and she wanted to share it with others, and the spirit with which she did her talking. She wasn't an orator. She could hardly speak and be heard, but she could make people understand what she is trying to tell them. Her friends could understand her. It wasn't pretty talk, but it wasn't skillful use of the language. But she put her point across, and I baptized her friends because she had taken an interest in them, and she'd tried to answer their questions, and she'd tried to tell them what she'd learned. I think what we need is people who think it's the gospel that is powerful, and they'll take it with them. What about the church right now in America, today? What is the situation on the inside? I've been called this week. One night after service, I got home and went to bed. Then I got a call. I'm to be in a meeting beginning the third Sunday in this month over at Isabel, just south of Russellville. I've been there off and on since 31 years ago, my first meeting. They had an able preacher scheduled to come for the meeting. But he has been asked to leave a church in Middle Tennessee. And when he left, he carried as many as he could with him. Now he's suing for his old job back as preacher. He wants the building back and the job back as the preacher there. And he's going to court, brethren against brethren, suing publicly, fussing in a trial about who's going to preach there, who's going to have charge of the building. Well, Isabel didn't want that man to preach. And they had a meeting already announced. It was already scheduled. So they called and asked if I could come to their relief. Marlon Chapman in Hartsel, good friend of mine. I've appreciated him, preached to him several years. He had two little girls, maybe 10 and 12 when we moved there. But they grew up and married young men who preach. And one of them is preaching at a place where the son of an elder committed murder. And they put him in the pen. And I don't know all the details, but I understand the elder was asked to step down as an elder. Somehow his attitude or whatever, I don't know all that. But he decided he didn't want to step down, so he is in the courts suing the church for his job back as elder. Can you imagine an elder who got his job back at a church that didn't want him? What could he do as an elder if he gets his job back? We live in an age when things like that happen. People have no regard for what they may do to the name of the Lord and to the church he loved and purchased with his own blood. I don't mean that's everywhere. I don't mean that Eastside's about to have a lawsuit over who's going to be an elder. But that's in our generation. And here's something else that's true now. Churches just split wide open. And the one section over here believes thus and so, and the other faction believes the same thing. Exactly. Split, and you couldn't tell the difference in them as to belief. But all the bitterness. At one place, the gospel preacher who was preaching is older than I am now when he stood in the pulpit at the time that was at a fever hot pitch. Somebody stood up in the audience and said, "That's a lie." The preacher was Roy Cogdell. And the man in the audience stood up and said, "That's a lie." And somebody else got up in the pulpit and there was stirring and commenting and all going on at once at a worship service on Sunday morning. We live in a time when every point of difference becomes a very hot issue, very heated issue. And there are so many things brought up, from whether we should have a song after the sermon that we'd sing to encourage people to come and make the good confession. Is an invitation song scriptural? Should we have the Lord's Supper Sunday night for those that were not able to be there in the morning because of good reason? I'm not trying to bring up problems just in order to get a problem started here. I'm just saying that there are problems today that are big issues that we didn't think were issues at all. 40 years ago, 25 years ago, there, every issue now tends to become bitter. And the unity and the name and the goodwill at the church services is disregarded. And somebody wants his way and his preference. Not so much the glory of the Lord. It's in Philippians 2 that he mentioned the lowliness of mind. "Fulfill ye my joy, that ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves." That suggestion, carried out, would do wonders for the church in the mid-1980s in America. I mentioned last night, you hear of a preacher who's been preaching several years, very able man, and now he's taken up with somebody else's wife. That kind of thing goes on. You find worldliness creeping in where you'd be surprised. Back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, maybe a little group started in the American Legion Hall or someplace until they could get a building of their own. And it was a group of very strict, very conscientious people. And now there's a laxness, a worldliness. Their children maybe have grown up to be kind of like the common crowd, the common herd. Immodest, if I know what immodesty is. Very much interested in the school dances. Not all that interested anymore in Bible classes. I'm talking about sons of daughter and daughters of good people. People that apparently have had conviction, stood for them back 20 years ago, 25. Our lessons in the mornings this week have been dealing with things that bother and ups and downs of our brethren. I'm not sure it's the best type of study. I think about those people who 45 years ago were saying, one thing about it, if you attend the churches of Christ, you'll hear gospel. You'll hear Bible. I hope we haven't been missing the Bible records and the principles of the Word even today or yesterday when we're talking about things in our country in comparatively recent times. Let there be peace, but not peace based upon compromise. Let us be able to earnestly contend for the faith without becoming enemies. Paul withstood Peter to his face because he was to be blamed, as recorded in Galatians chapter 2. Peter later wrote in 2 Peter about the beloved brother Paul, spoke highly of him. Peter was working hard among the Jews, the circumcision, as Paul called it, Paul was out working among the Gentiles, but they appreciated each other's work. I would like for the classes here to deal with practical problems and let Bible be taught in Bible classes. I'm afraid little people can go to classes and be entertained well and learn very little about the Bible. I believe little people are capable early to learn a lot about the Bible. But they often are not taught Bible. I think a lot of our little workbooks could be thrown in the wastebasket to great advantage and let somebody tell them a Bible story. Teach them Bible, Bible, Bible. We need Bible in all of our classes. I'm not saying it's wrong to have some written questions but the lesson should be a Bible lesson. People need to be taught the marriage law somewhere. We need to be taught everything the Bible teaches. And I'm afraid the teaching program is not always good. To whatever extent you do a very good job in your teaching program, I congratulate you and I wish you well. Give a lot of thought to it and try to teach something worthwhile in Bible classes. No reflection on Dan's preaching, but I think classes of the highest type can sometimes mean more than sermons from the pulpit. It was true in my case. Brother Benny Brown's Bible class Sunday morning, as I look back, it touched my life more than the sermons that were preached Sunday morning. It's been a privilege to be with you, and I appreciate your patience. You've put up with my ramblings. I wish we could baptize somebody this morning. It would do something for all of us, and certainly it would mean something to the one who would obey the gospel. Come, if you will, while we stand together and sing.